I have massaged my foot again and again today, and now I will put a compress of hot water on it. Perhaps I shall be able to walk tomorrow. If not, you must go away and try to save yourself. Do not be sorry on my account. All that happens comes from some cause. This accident is a result of my previous deeds. No gods or men or anybody but myself are responsible for it, and it would be useless to lament about it. Now let us sleep. And we both slept soundly while the snow still fell and fell, without ceasing. The next day Yongdan could stand. I tied his bag and mine in one load, which I carried, and, as I had done when leading him back to the Safag after the accident, I helped the lama to walk. We were progressing at a snipier's pace. When we again reached the wooded hills, I cut a branch at the end of which I fixed a short piece of wood and wrapped it round with our empty provision bags to form a kind of cushion. This provided the young man with a primitive crutch, and he could thus proceed without my help. During my scouting tour the day before, I had seen the valley narrowing in a way which made me fear that we could not proceed close to the stream. I had more confidence in a track which we had seen climbing through the forest when coming down from the Ainila. It branched a little before entering the pasture land, and very likely it followed the same direction as the stream higher up, having been cut through the jungle because the bottom of the valley was not passable. We could, no doubt, have found some short cut to it without going as far as the spot from where we had just noticed it, but it would have been imprudent to attempt steep slopes through the bushes with Yongdan, who had great difficulty in walking, even in the trodden tracks. So we went a long way, knee-deep in the snow, until we reached the path which was well marked by a neatly cut line between the trees. The weather cleared at that time, and had it not been for the difficulty of proceeding in the snow that 65 hours of continual fall had accumulated, and the sorrow I felt at seeing the painful efforts made by Yongdan, the walk would have been rather pleasant. We were now in the midst of fine alpine scenery which must have been charming in spring and later summer, after the wet season. Unfortunately, I began to share something of the physical misery of my friend. That morning I had noticed a small gap in my boot through which my right big toe began to appear. Hours of tramping had transformed the little hole into a wide mouth that opened and closed at every step, as if my leg had been a strange animal, feeding on snow as it went. As for my left foot, it did not fare much better, for the sole of their boot had become almost entirely unsewn on one side. I began to suffer cruelly. Fresh snow is especially dangerous, it burns and causes sores. Tibetan hillmen, though their skin is rather tough, take great care to avoid direct contact with it. It was getting late, and we had forfeited all hope of reaching a village that day. No trace of cultivation, no cattle were seen, and it also seemed that we would find no shelter, for we had searched in vain for the Dokpa's summer huts which, according to the man who had accompanied us to the top of the Ainila, existed on the path going down to the inhabited valleys. Covered with snow, they were perhaps not easy to discover. Or could it be that, unlucky till the end, we had missed our road? That question formed the topic of the few words which we exchanged. We had given up asking each other about our respective efforts and pains. We knew that we were both struggling with all our might and unable to relieve each other's suffering. Prattling about it was useless. Later on, we also dropped, as idle and tiring, the question of the Dokpa's huts or whether we had missed our way. Night came and snow began to fall again. The sky was pitch dark, but a dim, dull light, that made me think of Hades, seemed to ascend strangely from the white ground and issue from the snow-clad trees. White from head to foot, mind and body benumbed, we continued at a limping gait our silent tramp. In that fantastic landscape, we looked like two queer ghosts en route to answer the call of a Tibetan wizard, or the ragged attendants of some needy Father Christmas of the wilds. Father Christmas, an association of ideas took possession of my thoughts. Were we not in December? Yes. But the concordance of dates between the Gregorian and the Sino-Tibetan calendar, which I had used for years, was not clear in my memory. I would consult, when free to do so, the Chinese Foyin calendar I had in my bag. Gradually Yongdan fell behind and I continued to drag myself aimlessly along. Villages, huts, any kind of shelter, seemed out of reach. To camp in the deep snow was impossible. Then what? A sudden shock shook me from my torpor. I had knocked myself against something hard. I looked. It was the top of a rustic fence. A fence. The Dokpa's summer camp, of which our guide had spoken. We were on the right way, and here was a shelter to sleep in. I could hardly believe it. I laid my hand on the wood and followed along it as if I feared that fence and huts would vanish, slipping away from my hold. I arrived at the gate of the enclosure and from the vaguely discerned a large square cabin and several smaller ones. I shouted the good news to the Lama, Dim, Dim. Camp a Chickdug. Means, here, here. There is a house. Without waiting for him I entered the camp. Next the men's room was a horse shed. I put my load down under it and began immediately to clear away the snow heaped high before the door. Yongdan arrived while I was thus busied. We happily found a good quantity of firewood and dry cow dung under the shed, and we first lighted a fire there, the room itself being too dark to locate the hearth. As soon as the burning branches gave us some light, we carried them into the hut, which we found rather large, with a fireplace and, on both sides of it, boards covering the ground to sit and lie on. The happiest discovery was another supply of fuel. After the nights spent in the Sar Fug, the warmth that spread into the closed room thrilled voluptuously in me the epicure which is always lurking in the corner of the most ascetic hearts. Before sleeping, we drank a bowl of hot water sprinkled with tsampa, leaving the tea for tomorrow's meal, and Yongdan put a hot compress around his foot. I consulted my calendar, it was the 22d of December. Yongdan's foot was less stiff and less painful on the following morning. But the young man still needed his crutch. And I was now in trouble, in my turn, for I could not proceed without sewing new soles on my boots. The day before, my toes had been burnt and half frozen. Blisters and bleeding sores made my gait as lame as that of my son. It would have been really dangerous to start, practically barefooted, on a new tramp in the snow. Nothing in his monastic study had prepared the Lama for a cobbler's work, and he found it very difficult. As for me, I knew nothing whatever of this craft, and the only help I could give him was to unstitch the worn-out piece of leather. It was 1 o'clock when the boots were ready. We hesitated to start. The existence of a Dokpa's abandoned summer camp at this spot had shown us that we were still far from the permanently inhabited region. Most likely, traveling at such a slack pace, we should not reach it before darkness came. That meant one more tramp at night and we began to feel the effects of prolonged fasting on our overtaxed endurance. On the other hand, to rest the remainder of the day was to increase the length of our starvation. The choice between these equally unenjoyable alternatives was hard. The bright fire tempted us. We decided in favor of the warm shelter during the night and a very early start before daybreak. The weather did not clear, it snowed without interruption. A little before sunset, Yongdan, who wished to ascertain if the condition of his sprained ankle had improved, went to another Dokpa's enclosure situated in the same clearing, and told me that he had seen from there the path we would follow on the morrow. The fire was revived long before daybreak. We turned our tea bag inside out and shook it over the kettle so that the last atom of tea dust would fall into the boiling water. Then, after a brief, purely liquid breakfast, we proceeded straight to the place Yongdan had marked the day before. It was thrill dark and snow fell heavily. The path seemed to be narrower than it had been above, but Tibetan tracks grow as the forest makes them, and the forest is a capricious road builder. We walked painfully until nearly noon. GND then, to our dismay, we realized that we were going in a wrong direction. We ran into thickets and steep slopes, with no more traces of a path. Had we wandered after having started in the right direction? I doubted it. Most likely we had been wrong from the beginning, entering one of those trails on which cattle roam in the hills, of which a number are always to be found near pasture grounds. Be that as it may, we could but retrace our steps to the Dokpa's encampment. Any attempt to look for the track from our present position would but lead us still farther astray. We had not gone far. Neither the llama, who still used his crutch, nor I with my sorely bleeding feet, could progress quickly. But far or near, it was the time needed to reach our starting point that was of importance. The consequence of such a mistake for people who had already fasted 3 days was really serious. We did not always find our tracks easily. The snow had partly effaced them, and Yongden had frequently to rest, which caused more delay. The ranges which we were crossing were covered with forests of holy oak trees, and reminded me once more of Christmas. It was Christmas Eve, and I pictured the joyful agitation of so many in Western lands, and the sorrow of too many others who do not even receive the crumbs which fall from the rich man's table. How far I was from all these things, in that solitary woods. I broke a small branch of holy oak, meaning to give it, later on, to a friend of mine, if I escaped from these mountains and that snow which seemed determined to keep me. But so unexpectedly do things happen, that when I brought the holy of the Virgin Po Forest to the western land, the man for whom it was meant had departed for a still more mysterious land than that of the Pippas. A bowl of hot water was again the only refreshment we could get when we arrived at the Dokpa's hut. I wanted to go scouting immediately, for we ought at any rate to avoid another mistake the next day. We both began to feel very giddy. We heard strange sounds of bells, and although we did not suffer many pangs of hunger, it was certain that unless we got some food before long, we should lack the strength necessary to reach the villages. Yongden insisted on going himself to look for the road, while I rested near the fire. I yielded to his kind entreaties, and the poor fellow started again over the snow, his staff in one hand and his crutch under the other arm. Time passed. The lack of provisions dispensed with the trouble of cooking. I had but to fill the kettle with snow, to melt it and boil the water. Then I could lie down and think. I fancied a few of my acquaintances in my place. I saw some of them swearing at God, the devil, their companions, and themselves. I saw others weeping and praying on their knees. Most of them, I know, would have blamed my quietness and that of my young companion. A Pali verse sung sweetly in my memory, "Happy indeed we live, known are the anxious unanxious." It was nearly dark when Yongden returned. This time he said that there could be no mistake. He had but faintly seen a trail the day before and had taken it for the main path. Darkness and snow, when we had started, had prevented us from discovering the mistake, which was really an absurd one, for the true track, although its entrance was hidden by fir trees scattered all around the clearing, was not very difficult to find. Nevertheless, he had followed it for quite a long time. There was no need to worry about the matter. It was really the right one. The news was most comforting, but I did not like the look of the young man. He was pale, with glowing and feverish eyes. He drank 2 bowls of hot water and immediately fell asleep. I remained for a while watching him. He was restless and from time to time he moaned. Gradually, however, he became calmer and I closed my eyes to sleep. A noise of steps on the boards and a confused muttering awakened me. The dim light of the smoldering embers disclosed the llama tottering toward the door, his staff in his hand. Where was he going? In no time I was on my feet. "What is the matter with you?" I asked. "Are you ill? Snow is heaping up," he answered with a strange voice, as if dreaming. "We sleep here, and it falls. Let us start. It will be too late." He was only half conscious and undoubtedly under the influence of a nightmare. I tried to calm him, to persuade him to lie down again. He did not appear to understand, and was lost in his own idea. He wanted to start. I could see that he was raving. His hand was burning with fever. It was the result of the long tramps in the snow, the fasting, and the pain caused by the sprained ankle. With sudden violence he reached the door and opened it. "Look," he said, "it snows." Heavy snow was falling. A new white mound could be seen blocking the passage which we had cleared several times since we had first arrived at the camp. A draft of cold air blew into the hut. "Do not stay here," I commanded the llama. You are ill. The cold will make you worse. We must start, start at once, he repeated obstinately, and, trying to drag me away, he cried, you will die, Jetsma. Come quick. Come as. I gave him a push, kicked the door shut, and endeavored again to make him lie down near the R, in spite of his struggles. Fever and the wild idea of saving my life had increased the natural strength of the sturdy young fellow. He staggered on his bad foot and did not appear to feel the pain. What would happen if he succeeded in breaking out? I remembered, terrified, that the clearing ended in a precipice only a few feet away. I succeeded in throwing a few branches on the fire, and the sudden bright light broke the trend of Yongdan's feverish vagaries. What? What? He said, looking around. And he no longer resisted my efforts to make him lie down. I made a big fire and placed some ash snow on the young man's head. He then fell asleep again, but I dared not relax my watch and remained seated the rest of the night. Did I doze and dream? I heard the feeble jingling of a bell, lower down the hill. Who could be traveling in that snow, and at that hour? I listened, fearing that someone might enter, but after a time the jingling died away. Such was my Christmas Eve in that land of Po. When day broke I did not dare to awaken my companion. Sleep is a powerful medicine and I placed more faith in it than in the few tabloids I carried with me. It was already late when he opened his eyes. I saw at once that he was better. He had but a faint remembrance of what had happened in the night, and thought it was altogether a dream. We prepared the hot water that once more constituted our breakfast. Had we had only a little butter or one or two pinches of tsampa to throw in it, we might have felt a trifle refreshed, but that plain water, even boiling hot, was nothing of a cordial. As I expressed my feelings aloud, ending jocularly with the wish that some compassionate mountain god might bring us even the smallest piece of butter or fat, Yongdan looked at me in a peculiar way. What is the matter? I asked. Well, he replied, hesitatingly, if you were not too particular about the fat, I might be the mountain god. What do you mean? He laughed. You are somewhat Tibetan in your ways, but perhaps not enough to do what a true Tibetan, in your case, would do. Go on. Have you something left in your bag? Yes, he answered. A bit of bacon with which I rub the soles of our boots to keep them waterproof, and some bits of skin which were left from the new soles I cut the day before yesterday. Throw them all in the pot and add a little salt if there is any left, I ordered, the soul of a true Tibetan arising in me. He did so, and half an hour later we were tasting a turbid beverage whose flavor was a matter open to discussion, but to a certain extent it satisfied the craving of our empty stomachs. Christmas merriment continued. The weather cleared and the sun appeared shyly soon after we had left the Dokpa's camp. As we descended we found the snow less deep. The path continued through thick forests, and we met another Dokpa's encampment, which was not a good omen for the nearness of our goal. A little below it, we crossed a third feeder of the river Po, a small torrent rushing down from the side of the Gotsala. We also saw the path which led to the pass itself. Neither villages nor fields nor anything that could suggest the neighborhood of human habitations could yet be discovered. Evening would come soon. Was our fast to continue? Below the path, in a narrow clearing, I noticed a small hut which I pointed out to Yongdan. Would it be wise to stop there? We had just time to collect some wood before darkness had set in beneath the big trees. To mention food was useless. That topic seemed as if it were to become forever foreign to us and we were to live like the gods of the ethereal regions, feeding on scents and pure air. We grew bewildered. We should not reach a village that day. On approaching the hut, we were most astonished to see a man standing at its door. This was our first meeting with a Popa in his own land, and the strange stories about robbers and cannibals that are current all over Tibet about that dreaded tribe, rose immediately in our memories. Yet we did not show any sign of our thoughts. I simply asked, politely, Kasho, sir, may we be allowed to enter to make a fire? Come in, answered the Popa brilliantly. We went down the road, crossed the clearing, And our astonishment became still greater when we saw about a dozen men seated inside the cabin around the fire. What could they be doing in the midst of the forest? We were politely welcomed. The men manifested extreme surprise and looked at one another with an air of mystery when they heard that we had crossed the Ainila. Yongdan deemed it useless to tell them about our supplementary promenade in the other valley, so that they thought we had come straight down from that pass. Certainly, they said, you both have got powerful Pola and Moaya. Without their help you would have perished in the snow, for the pass is now completely blocked. The special heavenly protection which we enjoyed impressed the Papas in our favor. A place of honor was given to the Lama next the fire, and we were invited to produce O'er bowls for some tea, while the men apologized for the lack of tsampa to eat with it. They had just finished their meal when we arrived. Even without tsampa, the generously buttered tea refreshed us delightfully. After some more inquiries about our country and our pilgrimages, one who appeared to be a personage of superior rank amongst the other Pippas asked the Lama if he knew the art of Mose, and all of them appeared greatly pleased when he answered that he did. What followed was first-rate material for a novelist, and at the same time threw some light on a picturesque and interesting side of Tibetan home politics. As nothing, or but very little, is known in the West about the true condition of Tibet, a few explanations are needed here to make the matter understood. It is an error to fancy Tibet as a homogeneous whole under gods of the paternal and maternal ancestors. A central government. Outside of the Ntsang provinces, the various tribes have always lived in independence under a number of petty rulers who were styled Jialpos, kings. During the Chinese suzerainty, the imperial officials did not interfere much with these local customs, but since they have been driven away by his troops, the Lhasa ruler has undertaken to bring under his direct authority the whole of the Tibetan territory which has escaped Chinese control. Those tribes who have greeted the departure of the Chinese officials as meaning entire freedom for them do not feel in the least inclined to accept as governors men from Lhasa who lack the prestige of the Chinese literati, representatives of the great Chinese emperor, who is, according to Lamaist belief, an incarnation of the god of knowledge and wisdom, Janpion. The Dalai Lama is worshipped by them as a spiritually exalted personality only, and though some of them may even go as far as to bow reverently to him from a distance, they strongly resent the appointment of governors or other dignitaries to rule over them, and especially their power to tax them and carry away to Lhasa the product of their levies. So, the inhabitants of Chozong had simply stoned their governor appointed from the capital, and besieged him in his Zong, where he had run in haste for shelter. The enraged official had, however, been able to flee at night from Chozong and to dispatch secretly a messenger to ask help from the Kalon Lama, a kind of viceroy reigning over eastern Tibet, whose seat is at Gyeongdo. The men of Chozong had in their turn learned of the departure of the messenger, and fearing that on the order of the Kalon Lama soldiers might be dispatched to their country on a punitive expedition, they had sent some of their friends to overtake the messenger, seize the letter he carried, and suppress its bearer. Our hosts were notabilities of the proud city which had stoned the alien governor. There was no question of cannibalism or of robbery. The Lama was merely required to tell whether the messenger would be caught. The joke this time had a serious side. It might prove dangerous for the seer if his oracle turned out to be wrong. The giant fellows seated around the fire were no doubt not easy to manage when irritated. My companion and I are both short of stature, and we looked amongst them like Tom Thumb of the nursery tales, in the ogre's den. But in this case the ogres numbered 14, and although we could almost feel confident that they did not eat the flesh of lost travelers, they could certainly not be fooled with impunity. The Lama asked them many questions about the roads which the Ponpo's messenger might have followed in order to leave the country, and thus I secured a good deal of geographical information. We also learned that a man had been dispatched toward the Ainila, but had turned back, and this explained the faint jingling of a horse's bell that I had heard before daybreak. The man had deemed it useless to proceed farther, realizing by the quantity of snow already heaped up at that level that the pass must be completely blocked, Therefore the astonishment of the Pippas had been all the greater when they had seen us coming from the other side of the range. They inquired again and again if we had seen nobody or no traces of steps. But we had truly seen neither, and certainly the Ponpo's messenger had not taken that road. After a good deal of muttering and gesticulation which were watched with deep attention by the interested spectators, the Lama declared something to this effect: "If your men run faster than the Ponpo's messenger they will catch him." But of course this was said in oracular style, wrapped in a quantity of solemn words, and was really very impressive. What prompted me, then? I could not say. The romance of that political intrigue of the wilds, these William tells of an unesford land, plotting in the heart of the forest against a Gessler from Lhasa, may have tempted me and Awak and the desire to play a part in the drama. Be that as may, in the silence which followed the prophecy of Yongdan, I pronounced, as if speaking for myself, "No harm will be done. All will end well." The 14 conspirators and my astonished companion gazed at me dumbfounded. What? What does she say? They asked after a while. Is she a Pamaf? Not exactly, answered Yongdan. My father was a Black Nagspa and she was his initiated consort. Indeed, replied some of the Pippas. Then, huddling themselves closer together, to give me room near the fire, they invited me to approach. Do not stay in that corner, Tangs Yum. You must feel cold. We are sorry that you have come too late to share our meal. So, truly, all that trouble will end well for us? Yakpo Chung Yong, good will arise, I answer ... then gazed into the fire, apparently sunk in profound thought. The Pippas did not feel very comfortable. I could see it. They rejoiced over the favorable oracles, but the company of the Black Nagspa's Yum in the middle of a forest after sunset seemed to them rather disturbing. So they took leave, requesting the Lama to say that they had all gone home, if someone should come and ask about them. The men had told us that we were not far from a village called Kolog, but what appeared a short distance to the sturdy hillmen might be a long one for tired, lame, and exhausted people like ourselves. We had drunk a quantity of buttered tea and had received a small piece of butter and a handful of tea, and these secured us a liquid breakfast for the morrow. It was better to spend the night under shelter. We may be certain, I told Yongdan, that these Pippas will not come back to rob us. They are too busy with their own business, and, moreover, they fear me. Footnotes here: a woman who, during mediumism trances, is possessed by a god or a demon who speaks through her mouth. If the medium is Nin, he is called Forwu. Nagsfa, a knower of the secret spell, a dreaded KBD of sorcerer. Literally, Spirit Mother. A polite title to address the mystic consort ad helper of a magician or any lama belonging to a tantric sect. The young man agreed, but he did not think that the hut was a safe place in which to spend the night. The followers of the Ponpa may have learned, he said, that his enemies have met here, and come at night to take them by surprise and kill them. They could mistake us for those who had stoned their master. We risked getting bullets through the door or being dragged before an official to explain who we were, or having to answer countless other embarrassing questions. I could not deny that he was right to a great extent. But it was already dark beneath the trees, and, not being acquainted with the path, we could easily have met with an accident of the same kind as that from which Yongdan was still suffering. As for being fired at or arrested, this could as well happen to us when tramping at night in the forest as in the hut. I would stay. Once we had decided to stop there, Yongdan went into the forest to cut wood. I gathered as much as was lying about near the cabin, and when I had finished I sat near the fire. All of a sudden, without any noise, a head appeared over the top of the door, which closed only about 3/4 of the entrance. A man looked hurriedly into the hut and pronounced a few words which I did not understand. He did not give me time to ask him to repeat them, and disappeared while I shouted, so that he might hear it, what the Lama had been requested to say. "They are all gone." Those could not be, it seemed to me, very compromising words, And if someone were looking for the conspiring purpose, they would not come to trouble us. Anyhow, the romance was to continue at the expense of our repose. A little later we heard a noise in the bushes, steps on the fallen leaves, dry twigs broken under the feet of an invisible wanderer.